Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
All right, it is my turn. I picked a story called Jeffdy is Five by Harlan Ellison, who we've featured in the past when we did I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream.
Oh, yes.
And it was weird.
That was a very, very early story with Rob.
Yeah, I was like, you know, what I said about not liking sci-fi, I'm sticking to it. It was a weird one.
This one's not quite sci-fi.
Well, I found it through a list of past Hugo Award winners, and I can't remember if he was a winner or a honorable mention. I was clicking through the site that we actually included in our newsletter, and I was just kind of clicking through to see which one I liked.
I think the Hugo also goes to fantasy.
Yes, it does. And so I don't know which category or whatever. Maybe this is what they're considering fantasy, but I like that it was a kid, so I ended up picking this one. Hume denied the existence of an absolute space in which each thing has its place. Borges denied the existence of one single time in which all events are linked. Jeffdy received radio programs from a place that could not, in logic, in the natural scheme of the space-time universe as conceived by Einstein, exist. But that wasn't all he received. He got mail-order premiums that no one was manufacturing. He read comic books that had been defunct for 3 decades. He saw movies with actors who had been dead for 20 years. He was the receiving terminal for endless joys and pleasures of the past that the world had dropped along the way. On its headlong suicidal flight toward new tomorrows, the world had raised its treasure house of simple happinesses, had poured concrete over its playgrounds, had abandoned its elfin stragglers, and all of it was being impossibly miraculously shunted back into the present through Jeffdy. Revivified, updated, the traditions maintained but contemporaneous, Jeffdy was the unbidding Aladdin whose very nature formed the magic lampness of his reality. And he took me into his world with him because he trusted me. We had breakfast of Quaker puffed wheat sparkies and warm Ovaltine. We drank out of this year's Little Orphan Annie shake-up mugs. We went to the movies, and while everyone else was seeing a comedy starring Goldie Hawn and Ryan O'Neal, Jeffdy and I were enjoying Humphrey Bogart as the professional thief Parker in John Huston's brilliant adaptation of the Donald Westlake novel Slayground. The second feature was Spencer Tracy, Carol Lombard, and Laird Kruger in the Val Lewton produced film of Lenigan versus the Ants. Twice a month, we went down to the newsstand and bought the current pulp issues of The Shadow, Doc Savage, and Startling Stories. Jeffdy and I sat together, and I read to him from the magazines. He particularly liked the new short novel by Henry Kuttner, The Dreams of Achilles, and the new Stanley G. Weinbaum series of short stories set in the subatomic particle universe of Renderna. In September, we enjoyed the first installment of the new Robert E. Howard Conan novel, Isle of the Black Ones, in Weird Tales, and in August, we were only mildly disappointed by Edgar Rice Burroughs' fourth novella in the Jupiter series featuring John Carter of Barsoom, Corsairs of Jupiter. But the editor of Argosy All Story Weekly promised there would be two more stories in the series, and it was such an unexpected revelation for Jeffdy and me that it dimmed our disappointment at the lessened quality of the current story. I wanted to read a section that captured the kind of crux of the story, which is whether it's sci-fi or fantasy, what it asks you to do in order to enjoy it is to suspend your disbelief and just enter the world. And I wanted to read a section that captured just the pure joy that it was.
Oh, yeah.
Imagine what this could be. I love stories with kids where they are protagonists, where they're young. Jeffdy is five, and five is pretty young.
Yeah.
It's not seven. You know what I mean? It's not even six.
Yes.
Like, five is like you're having conversations, but they don't make sense yet. And so even Jeffdy is at an age where you couldn't explain to this kid if he wanted to the fact that what he's able to do in the world that he lives in is rare and special. He's able
Yeah.
at that age to take it for granted. Unfortunately, I don't know that that's like the spell that's lifted by the end. I think the spell that's lifted by the end is a little different. You know what I mean? I would have liked if it had been more directly tied to like his naivete. Instead, it's like we break the Jeffdy spell by introducing him to like color TV.
Well,
That's not as
he too much
exciting to me.
exposure to the present.
Yeah, exactly. And then that's what kind of like breaks his head a little bit. But then he goes and gets beat up by a couple kids that are freaking out when he.
That's where the 5-year-old thing kind of threw me because I was like,
Oh, I
these are kids who are
know.
beating up a 5-year-old. A
I
five-year-old.
know. And they beat him to death.
It's literally called a bloody pulp.
Yeah, horrible. Like I said, I don't really think we get to explore what it was like for him to necessarily like come of age even. I mean, he doesn't live to learn a lesson about what that beating was like. Maybe that's a blessing in disguise, right? That he was innocent his entire life. But basically the story is about what if this kid, somehow this kid is tapping into not just the past. He's not just stuck in the past. It's the past as if it had continued on that way, as if technologies had not developed, as if actors hadn't died. It's like he said in the paragraph that I think I read, you know, new versions of the same old comic books, and only he can experience it until he invites his lifelong friend up. And this lifelong friend was also 5 when Jeffy was 5, but he got older. Yeah. And Jeffy just stayed the same. And I thought about reading a section with the parents, because you learn a little bit about the parents in the story, right? And they're basically like caricatures of sad sack parents who imagine, you know, if Jeffy had some kind of debilitating condition, which maybe at this time would have been like an iron lung. And these parents are just beside themselves. They're like, you know, we don't know if we're happy with Jeffy or not. This is a miserable way to live. And at first you're kind of like, you guys are terrible. Like, wouldn't you want, like, of all the ages, I mean, he's out of diapers, but you can't really leave him alone. He's innocent, but he's sort of self-aware, right? It seems like such a precious, perfect age that if your kid had to get stuck, it's better than 16. It's better than 1.
Yeah.
You know, he's sleeping through the night and he still loves you. But these parents are just so frustrated by it. They're like, you know, it'd be nice to leave the house. And, you know, they expected to be retired or vacationing, but
they're trapped in the same way that Jeffy is trapped.
Yes.
In this moment, but they're trapped knowingly. They know they're trapped. They can see the rest of the world moving on. And they're like,
right.
But he's still dragging us back here.
Oh, man. It makes me sort of hate the parents because, like I said, it could be something as debilitating as an iron lung where your child has no quality of life. And Jeffy does have quality of life. So anyway, they introduce the parents and things like that. But for the most part, we're like following along how this kid is in his own little bubble, and then suddenly his like friend is introduced to it, and his friend is like, this is incredible, this is wonderful, this is magical and selfish of me because I get to go and work my job and live my life, but
yeah.
I'm like indulging with Jeffy. I was so interested in it. Like I said, I wish that like the ending could have been more tied to like the loss of innocence versus the exposure to the real world directly. It kind of felt like the real world today, the modern world, and you can say this at any time you're living, is so much more dangerous than it was. I don't think that's the lesson here.
Well, I think all his ruminations in the beginning part of this, we should talk about the structure of it later, but all of his ruminations in the beginning of it where he's like, things that have been lost and like time changed the world and like all these things that I really liked when I was young are gone and like it's replaced by all this other stuff. It's like this same complaint that's been going on for millennia.
He literally starts with like the Clark bar. He's like, they don't make Clark bars. Like they, I'm like, oh my God, what is this about?
But then he finds this, like Jeffy has this connection with the past, right? One of the ruminations he keeps making is how the present kills the past. The present kills the past. And he keeps saying that. And at the end, present does kill Jeffy, right? He's exposed to the TV. He goes to stand in line in a movie theater in the present time and he gets beat up and then he's brought back home. It's not specific that he died, but
yeah,
like a lot of his kind of angst over like, I should have taken him to a hospital and all these other things, you kind of infer that in any case, even if he lived, the past did not survive, right? This window into the past did not survive. So in a very literal way in this story, the present does wind up killing the past.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's kind of the emotional. I get what you mean about the ending. You want more to it in some ways, but I think he was just hitting that kind of literal beat, if you will.
Right. I guess I thought like the window into the past that you're talking about, the strength of the window into the past was indicative of like Jeffy's health.
It was like an effect of Jeffy.
Yeah, like he was the conduit or something. And like, anyway, yeah, I know, I get what you're saying.
That might be along the lines of like, whose story is it, right? Is it the narrator's story or is it Jeffy's story? Like who, seems like it should be the narrator's story. And to wrap up his kind of arc, you want that more of what you're talking about. But if it's an, it could also not necessarily be a character's story, but more of an idea story, in which case the idea gets wrapped up by Jeffy's ending and that portal being closed.
Yeah, I guess the narrator narrator is the only dynamic character in the story. Jeff D is 5 and will be 5 and dies 5. You know, he doesn't even, like I said, experience the loss of innocence on the page. He doesn't get to survive this beating and think that was weird. And he doesn't even get to comment on what he's seeing on the television when it literally breaks his brain. We don't really get to understand what he understands in that moment. So it's got to be the narrator.
I mean, every character in this story besides the narrator is totally flat and like static. Even Jeff D. Jeff D is just the one thing.
Throughout.
Most of the story is just the narrator kind of, you know, bouncing off of Jeff D, who remains static, except for the tragic ending.
Yeah, like maybe this is a stretch, but it's like Cathedral, where the guy's blind. He's blind at the beginning, he's blind at the end. He didn't suddenly become poetic and like insightful. But, you know, the visitor to the story who experiences the change is the one that, you know, kind of comes into it. And he's not that the blind guy's not a flat character, but he exists, like you said, to be this foil.
Yeah, it's the two of them working together that creates that, like, it changes the character, like, gives him a revelation of a certain kind.
So Jeff D and this guy in Cathedral, they feel like good. They don't need to have any kind of dynamic shift because they are good. They are innocent. Like, they've achieved this higher, you know, and so the fact that they exist as foils doesn't necessarily make them flat, but that's their purpose. They're like a device, right?
Yeah, almost narrative.
The point
function.
Of the story, but yeah. So I guess it's the narrator's story and, you know, whatever he takes from it. It reminded me too, just like overall, I can't remember the name of it. And this goes back to what we were talking about off camera, where it's like, would I remember it if I called it my favorite story? But that Paper Tiger one.
Paper Menagerie.
Okay. So the Paper Menagerie story feels similar in the sense that there's an element of sci-fi or fantasy, and it's directly linked to when and how you believe in these things. I talked at the beginning about as a reader having to kind of like suspend your disbelief, but there's an element where the narrator themselves is suspending their disbelief. So this narrator, he too is kind of like, stick with me. I don't understand how this happened. And that's like the section that I read. I don't understand, but I do want to explain what my kind of takeaway was from it, you know? And there's something really cool about a story like that. You know, anytime I've ever said that I didn't initially like sci-fi and like fantasy, things like that. And then like, you know, all the stories that we've read in this podcast have changed my mind again and again, you know, just the idea that like, I don't really necessarily care about the premise. But these are like, I would argue my favorite like subgenre of that kind of thing, where it's like, just go with me for a second. Like, I know this is ridiculous. I'm not telling you to like enter the Game of Thrones world where I've developed hundreds of years of backstory. That's daunting, right? I'm just telling you to believe that maybe a 5-year-old can still listen to old radio programs. I'm like, okay, let's go.
There's this moment in there when he says, one Saturday afternoon, I came to take him to a double feature, and things I should have noticed so many times before, I first began to notice only that afternoon. That's when he finds him in the hideaway and he has the badge, right?
Yeah.
I love that moment. It's like, there's all these weird things that happen. Like, he's been listening to the radio. He's been reading comic books. He's been doing 5-year-old things this whole time from the past, but I didn't notice. I wasn't paying attention.
Yeah.
There's a distinction that Tolkien makes in an essay he wrote. The Coleridge quote is the suspension of disbelief. And Tolkien said, what you want from fiction, from fairy stories, is what his subject matter was. The essay is called On Fairy Stories. But he says, what you want is not a suspension of disbelief. What you want is to create literary belief. You want to create a world that's so strong and that so well made that the reader just believes it.
Yeah.
And that should be the goal, rather than the suspension of disbelief. That's one way to think about how well made stories are. And like, what Jeff D is offering him is like, hey, why don't you just believe that I'm still 5? Believe that this world still exists, you know?
Yeah.
And once he, like I said, that's paragraph, once I began to notice things I should have noticed so many times before, and he starts to like buy into it and accept it, then he's like, has the best couple of months of his life, right? He's like listening to the radio like he used to do. He's reading these comics and going to see movies. It's like this wonderful experience once he buys into it.
Yeah, I get what you mean when you say that like Tolkien is describing like for the reader themselves, like, I'm not supposed to read this and think for a second that Harlan believes this to be true. You know what I mean? I'm along for the ride.
Oh, no, of course. Yeah.
So I like the distinction because, you know, maybe it helps people who don't think that they're into sci-fi just kind of admit that there's a level of like lay to this, you know? I think people that think that like they don't like fantasy and stuff think that they have to read Lord of the Rings and then go LARPing in the park, you know? Nobody's asking you to do that. You don't have to buy into this completely.
No,
this doesn't have to be like, you don't have to like adopt any of this. This is just temporary. Just enjoy it on the page and for what it is.
We can read Faulkner and like that. Like, that's another world. I didn't live in that world.
Yeah.
And then we can read exactly. this, which is another world that has like magical things going on in it.
Yeah.
This story actually reminded me of Town of Birds.
Okay, yeah.
Because it has that kind of premise, that kind right. of like thing that's magical, this right. weird thing. And it's almost like a Kafka thing. Like,
yeah.
One day you wake up and you've been turned into a bug. What happens?
Yeah. You're like, just go with it. Yeah.
Just go with it. Just like, it means something. It doesn't even have to mean anything. Like Town of Birds, the author specifically said, doesn't mean anything. Right. That doesn't mean we can't take that and say it feels very similar to kids growing up and moving away, or it feels like yeah. you were talking about, very similar to like a heroin epidemic or something.
Yeah.
It could feel like those things and be similar to those things. But all it is the kids just turn into birds when they turn 15 yeah. or whatever. And in here, this kid is just 5. Just go with it.
Yeah. He's 5 forever.
He's 5 forever.
I wonder if one of the elements that makes stories like this palatable is the idea that hand in hand with the suspension of disbelief is like the innocence, and that these are children. And think of how easily you go and watch Toy Story. That's fantasy. Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? But it's not dragons. It's just a what if premise. And it's really easy yeah. to then, instead of calling it sci-fi, to call it something like imagination, right?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that's what makes stories like this also, for me, the same way when Stephen King is writing a story about kids, like you kind of anticipate that this is going to be something he's done before, where it's like, you know, this powerful loss of innocence thing, you know, whatever it is, whatever theme yeah. he's commonly writing. It's like, I do feel like when there is a child in a sci-fi thing like E.T., you're supposed to view this through that child's eyes. E.T.'s not scary to adults, you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's not even necessarily like powerful. There's not an adult that I like identifies with the alien. It's a child. And then when you think about it, you think about like when I watched that movie as an adult, I bawled my eyes out in the theater. They like played it again and I was like, oh my god, you know, because like maybe as a kid, I didn't appreciate the elements of, like, I was a kid when I watched it, so I didn't understand what it's like to watch it as an adult, and like that loss of innocence is a huge factor. So I think like a story like this with Jeffy, I mean, that's the whole premise of the whole point of this premise is like that suspended innocence and what happens when it's gone.
Tolkien's in that same essay, he does, and I wish I could remember it more specifically, but he addresses he says fairy stories aren't merely for kids. Like that's
yeah.
a lot of fairy story stuff that he's responding to was dismissive of fairy stories as being just kids' stories, right? And he's right. like, no, they deal with much bigger things. They can reach for much larger things. And like, that's what this story isn't about being a kid. I mean, it's about being a kid in certain ways. It's about nostalgia. It's about being grown up and remembering being a kid, right? So it's about being an adult. It's about yes. having lived it
and lost it in a way. Yeah. yeah. Like, yeah, it's just this inevitable thing. I think my takeaway might be something that all this in mind, like something along the lines of writing a story that's in the vein of like imagination, you know, like what if, and maybe it's sci-fi, maybe it's fantasy, or maybe it defies either of those like concrete boxes. But do you remember like the Indian in the cupboard?
Yeah, vaguely.
It's stuff like that. The idea that yeah. you could put a plastic figurine in a cupboard and it comes to life. That's something that as a kid was, oh my God, I was obsessed. I was like, yes, this is exactly what I want to happen. It was Toy Story before Toy Story, you know?
The rats of Nim. Just yeah. these like intelligent rats that have like this little society.
Right. The other one I wrote down that was like a chapter book that I remember reading when I was like in first grade was called like The Littles, and it was like tiny people that lived in your walls. You know, there's always an element in these stories where the adults can't see it and they're not paying enough attention, but they're there. They're there. And only kids, you know, can do it. I wonder if there's a world in which like we could, as adults, write stories like that that are not YA. You know, I think that's kind of what Jeff D is doing here. You know, no one would call this YA, but the premise could be one that would turn into like a YA book or film, whatever. But I think when you make it for adults, and then you acknowledge like what we talked about, like the loss of innocence or the fact that, you know, it's nostalgia. That's what adds this like powerful, powerful moments to it.
Yeah, because you're looking at adult themes, you know, kids.
Yeah.
Even YA, what is YA target? Teenagers?
I don't know. Right?
Whatever it is. They don't have that. It's not the same as being like 30 or 50 right. or whatever.
Yeah. So it's like writing about kids for adults. That's my takeaway.
It was one thing about kids' stories and even YA stories to a certain degree is like the adults can't solve the problem.
Right.
For some reason, kids have to solve the problem.
That's also a Stephen King thing, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of like the basic foundational premise of any right. kid story is like the adults have to step back because it's a story about kids.
Right.
And there's a narrative reason they can't do it. There's just a unacknowledged assumption because of the genre that they can't do it. But whatever it is, the kids have to save the world because the adults won't do it. And I think one way to think about making like a kid's story for adults is to bring the adults back into it, right?
Yeah.
It's like the story about being a parent. It's, again, it's about kids, but it's the parent's point of view. So it's not then a kid's story anymore, even though it's about kids.
What is your takeaway?
Oh, yeah. I know I've had this takeaway before. I think I had it when we did the Bartleby story, the first one that Rob brought in about the balloon. It was like one of the first ones we did.
Yeah.
The balloon.
Yeah.
But was just taking a premise and like running with it, right? Doing like the Kafka thing.
That was a very bizarre one. Yeah.
But it's a similar thing. Like, what if my feeling of regret was expressed as a giant balloon that's like collapsed over the city? Or what if there's a kid that didn't grow up, like had access to all childhood things forever? What if kids just turn into birds when they turn 15? Like, these are really good. What if there's a library that extended into infinity and had every possible printing of every book, right? These are just premises that you can make stories out of. I mean, there are things you got to do to make it a story. Like, you have to have an emotional arc of some kind, which requires a character to have emotions. There's things that kind of fall out of making it into a story. But just like thinking about premises is a really fertile way to think about stories, like, and come up with stories.
Oh, because I mean, like, we're doing that all the time.
Yeah.
In real life, you know what I mean? And even people that aren't writers are like, oh my God, can you imagine what if?
Yes. What if? I remember my mom always said when I was a kid, like, I didn't ask a lot of why questions. Like, that's like the stereotype for kids. Yeah. She said the questions I always asked was, what if? What if this happened? And she's like, oh my God.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's cute. I wonder if there's a way that you can kind of pinpoint the kids that ask why instead of what if. Like, the what if are going to go into art, you know?
Maybe. Or storytelling of some kind.
Yeah, we're not going to make any money, but we're very creative and imaginative. And the other kids are going to be like rocket scientists. All right. Well, thanks, guys.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. And for industry news, writing tips, and great short fiction, join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/NaplesWritersWorkshop. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at NaplesWritersWorkshop.com.